You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from best-selling Wisconsin-based author Nicholas Butler. He joins to talk about what he's reading now and over the last few months, and what's at the top of his to-do list, and how to keep on keeping on during the pandemic. Now, 2020 marks 30 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. It was the first comprehensive civil rights law for people with disabilities, and for many people, it was a life-changing piece of legislation. A book released this year shares stories from a number of authors in part to mark that anniversary. It's called Disability Visibility, First-Person Stories from the 21st Century. The book is a collection of essays, testimonies, blog posts, manifestos, all written by people living with disabilities. Amanda Riom is a feminist activist and writer who contributed to the Disability Visibility anthology with her essay, Why My Novel is Dedicated to My Disabled Friend, Maddie. Amanda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Hi.
And Alice Wong is a disabled activist and the founder and director of the Disability Visibility Project. She's editor of the new book. Alice, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Alice, what inspired you to start gathering stories from people living with disabilities for your Disability Visibility Project?
Well, I think it started when I was really a young person. You know, I was born disabled. I knew that I was different from everybody else at a very young age. And I really didn't see or saw myself reflected much in books, film, television, you name it. And, you know, I thought that was normal. You know, I didn't realize that I was part of this larger history, this larger culture and community until I was a little bit older, let's say in my teenage and early adult years. So speaking of the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, I was a sophomore when it passed in 1990. And, you know, it's really changed a lot of lives. And by becoming connected to the disability community, as I got older, I just really became a fan. You know, I've read so many amazing books, essays, just tweets by disabled people. And I think at the heart of a lot of what I do is that, you know, I love to hype the work of other disabled artists, activists, and writers. And this is really just a collection of work that I feel like is speaking to the present. In the terms of these are 21st century stories, which means they're published from the year 2000 to 2019.
Amanda, Alice talked about the importance of community. She writes about that also in her introduction. And the story you share in the book really speaks to that. Can you share some of your piece, Why My Novel is Dedicated to My Disabled Friend, Maddie? Talk about the relationship that inspired this piece.
Yeah, so unlike Alice, I became disabled about 3 years ago when I had a severe head injury that I had to learn how to kind of walk and talk again after that. And it's left me with a lot of severe impairments around fatigue, as well as a complication with using computer screens. Now, unfortunately, I was and still am a writer. And so writers need screens in order to write their work. So what happened after I was injured, I became really frustrated and a bit depressed because I was trying to finish a novel, which was basically done when I was injured. And I just didn't have the capacity to edit it on the screen. So I printed it out and was trying to edit it that way. But because of the visual impairments I have or visual processing issues I have, I couldn't then transfer the edit. So I thought I was doomed never to write again. But I ran into or I met a woman named Maddie who it turns out also had a head injury. And what was interesting about that is that we ended up figuring a way where we could help each other. Maddie was struggling to find full-time work because of her head injury. and needed some flexible part-time work, and I needed someone to help me transcribe my edits. And so that's essentially what Maddie did. And it's a really great metaphor for what a lot of people within the disability community like to talk about a lot, which is the fact that we are all far more interdependent than we like to think we are, even though disabled people are often more visibly interdependent or seen as interdependent by others, all of us experience different levels of interdependence, and none of us can actually survive without each other. So my story is really a beautiful story about disabled interdependence and community, in which two people with very similar but slightly different injuries were able to help each other not just achieve goals, but also heal in a lot of ways through community.
We're talking to Alice Wong and Amanda Riom about the new anthology called Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century. Alice, Amanda was giving us a sense there of the diversity of stories also shared in this anthology. A lot of people with different kinds of disabilities and different backgrounds, sometimes being members of ethnic groups or having other things that work with their disabilities to give them other challenges in life. Can you talk about the importance of representing this wide scope of experience here?
Well, I think that this is part of the thing that's really misunderstood about disability is that, you know, we exist in every single community, and that, you know, for a long time, I think the overall representation of disability, whether it's in history or popular culture, let's say, has been overwhelmingly white, and it's often focused on what we think of as apparent disabilities, but, you know, for example, somebody who uses sign language, a wheelchair user, somebody who might use a service animal. You know, the reality is it's much more broad and, you know, nuanced. There's a lot of people with non-apparent disabilities that are often just not represented or not even truly included. For example, you know, people with chronic illnesses, people with pain, you know, people with intellectual disabilities, people with mental health disabilities. There's a lot of people who are definitely considered, protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act that may never identify or say the word disabled, but, you know, they're definitely considered part of the community. At least that's my personal approach and my personal opinion. That's, you know, we need to make sure that people feel seen and heard, and that they don't have to use certain words, but that they're welcome into this very, you know, diverse and complicated, non-monolithic community.
And Amanda, Alice mentioned the public perception of people living with disabilities. And you talk about that a little in your piece. A lot of times the story is, I think, what some people call inspiration porn. There's this one person and they pull themselves up. They overcome the obstacles on their own through grit and gumption. And I think in your essay, you make the case, as you were saying earlier, it's more complicated than that. And it's more, again, more of a community approach than we sometimes see.
Yeah, and I've written about this elsewhere as well. So I was injured with a head injury. And so the idea is that we often think people recover, and we valorize stories when people recover. So what does that mean for people like me and like my friend Maddie, who don't recover, who have severe impacts? It often means that the way people perceive us is somehow deficient, in that we haven't tried enough to recover, or we haven't, or if we tried harder, we would recover in the future. So this whole idea of the super crip, which is often talked about, is kind of this narrative that's constructed. It's supposedly supposed to be fun and lovely to and heartwarming, but it actually serves to cause harm to a lot of disabled people. So I've experienced a lot of ableism. I have what's known as an invisible disability. So if you meet me, if you see me, there's nothing visible about me that's disabled, or that you would recognize as a disability, what we see as visible disabilities. But I could have severe symptoms right in front of you, and you wouldn't be able to know it. And so it's that disjunction between the lack of visibility and the fact that a lot of people end up not believing people who have invisible disabilities. So things like chronic illness or pain, or and part of mine is my disability is chronic fatigue. And people don't believe that. And people only want to celebrate those people who somehow overcome different aspects or recover. And that's not all of us. And we can still live wonderful and beautiful lives despite that, and lives that are extremely valuable and interconnected with disabled and non-disabled people alike.
We're talking to Alice Wong and Amanda Riom about the new anthology, Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a disability and a story to share? What would you like people to know? What are you thinking about on the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act? Are there issues of access or discrimination that still need to be solved? What would be one thing that can make your life easier and allow you to be more fully engaged in society? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your experiences. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Alice Wong, editor of the new book, Disability Visibility, First Person Stories from the 21st Century. Amanda Riom is also with us. She's one of the contributors to that anthology. And we want to hear from you. What books, movies, or media about and by disabled people would you like to recommend? What did you enjoy or learn from it? If you yourself are living with a disability, what do you wish other people understood? If you have what's considered an invisible disability, have you had a hard time getting others to believe that you are, in fact, living with that disability? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your thoughts. Alice, one thing that struck me about a lot of the essays is that people are expressing the joy they take in their lives. It's not just about the obstacles and challenges. It's not in any way a request for pity from other people, whether it's, I think, a Muslim person with cerebral palsy talking about the joy of fasting during Ramadan, as tough as that can be, or stories of the creativity or embracing community. Can you talk about the importance of that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't separate all of the joys and brilliance and innovation and all of the beauty that comes from having a being disabled. And I think, this sounds very, to the non-disabled people in the audience, they may be shocked, they may be kind of surprised that there is joy. And I think, this is not to gloss over the very real challenges, but I would also say that, there is so much brilliance. There's so much just culture that's created by disabled people. And this is very much, I think, in opposition to, prevailing ideas that still that disability is a problem to be fixed, and that, disabled disability is much of an individual phenomenon versus a collective movement. And that's how I really do see it. And I do hope that people become a little bit interested if they get to read this book and then discover more. In the back of my book, I do have a list of readings and resources if the people want to read more. So this is just a snapshot of 37 stories that I personally think are powerful, personal, and very political. And I really hope this gets people excited and curious.
And Amanda, as a creative person before your disability and now still after it, can you talk about the importance of, for you and the other contributors in this book, all very creative people, of expressing that creative side, sharing it, and other people paying attention to the creative works by people with disabilities?
Yeah, I think for me, it was interesting. When I was injured right afterwards, I told people I wouldn't write about my injury. That there were so many stories about people recovering from injuries. But disability changed my life, and it changed my life in part because of the ableism I experienced. So many people don't understand disability who are non-disabled, and they treat disabled people in really horrific and horrendous ways, in ways that in the first couple of years after my disability, I literally had to cut most of my former friends and even some family members out of my life because they couldn't figure out how to understand what I was going through and even just believe me when I was in pain. The idea that we don't believe people who have invisible disabilities, or we don't believe people who have disabilities, or the rhetoric in which we think there is no such thing as disabled joy, or where we bring suspicion and doubt to people who say that they're disabled or have chronic illness. These are really, really painful narratives to the disabled community, and they are very harmful. One of the things that I think is important and about writing about disability and why I write about it is to articulate the way in which that ableism harms. And that's actually, I write a lot about the joy, but there's a pain in this story too. The reason why Maddie and I connected so much was because we were the first people who could understand what it was like to go that we had met that who could understand what it was like to go through that. We became disabled and were surrounded by family members and friends who didn't understand and treated us in just horrific ways because they didn't understand. And so what I'm so happy about in seeing more work by disabled writers getting more visibility is that hopefully people will listen to that and they'll take some time to understand the way marginalization and oppression and the toxic narratives that we have about disability are causing very real harms interpersonally to disabled people, but also systemically by the way that we exclude disabled people from employment, in the ways that we deal with them in regards to social services. Disabled people often don't get enough funding in order to, like, who aren't able to work don't get funding in order to cover their basic needs. And this is terrible. This is horrible. This is a tragedy. And reading about disabled people and their lives, it's my hope that people who are disabled will feel a kinship in that pain and feel like they're not alone, but then also people who are non-disabled will maybe think a bit about how they've been acting and the ways in which marginalization and oppression occur around disabled people, especially those with intersecting marginalizations, as you were saying earlier, and change both interpersonally and our structures.
I want to bring on a caller now. Ellen is with us in Cedarburg. Ellen, hello.
Hi, I'm calling just to thank the two ladies for their work. I guess I have what could be called an invisible disability of the psychological depression and anxiety throughout my life, and it really has always been a struggle to feel like I'm of any kind of value or any kind of success. And the people that I found that helped me were other people with these types of disabilities, especially a group called the Grand Avenue Club here in Milwaukee. And I just found, I found that people have incredible beauty and strength. And I just want to thank these two ladies for showing us that.
Ellen, thank you so much for the call. Alice, Ellen kind of illustrates what you were saying earlier about the importance of hearing stories from other people with similar life situations, with similar, and in this case, struggles with depression for Ellen. In our last minute or so, Alice, talk about your hopes a little more for what comes out of this book and the stories in it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this, Ellen. You know, I really do hope that for the disabled readers of this book, that they feel seen and heard, that they realize that they are enough, and you know, any kind of feeling of just, you know, there's power in connecting with one another. And whether it's through friends, to our peers, or groups, there is real power when we are able to really tell our truths and share it with the world. So I just want to thank you for sharing your story with us, Ellen, and, you know, for everybody who's out there who is ready or not ready yet to be part of the disability community. I just do hope that people know that you are enough and that you are welcome and, you know, we're here. And I think that's all. I'll just end it like that.
That's a great place to end it. Alice, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rob.
And Amanda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Alice Wong is editor of the anthology Disability Visibility, and Amanda Riom is a writer with a disability who contributed to that book. 2020 marks 30 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. Coming up, Wisconsin author Nicholas Butler joins us to talk about what he's been up to during the pandemic, and he'll share some reading recommendations. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We know that it can be tough to keep up with the current events in a 24-hour news cycle. Besides daily news coverage, tune into Central Time on Wednesdays for a look at the week in Washington and all week long for conversations about issues that affect Wisconsinites. All that and more here on Central Time, weekdays from 3 to 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, the pandemic has changed the kinds of questions and greetings we ask people, whether we're talking to them for the first time in a while or the first time ever. Instead of how are you or where'd you go this summer, we might ask how have you been coping and what's your latest hobby? Our next guest is a local author we haven't talked to in a while. And we're going to catch up pandemic style. Nicholas Butler is the author of books including Shotgun Love Songs and his latest Little Faith. He lives near Eau Claire and writes a column for the Leader Telegram called Sawdust Stories. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I hear a lot of people talking about a changed pace of life and thinking maybe they want to keep some of that changed pace, maybe a slower pace, even when things go back to normal. Have you seen that in the people you know or even in your own life?
Well, I tell you, I mean, we sort of live out in the country. So when the pandemic, the stay-at-home measures first started, I felt like we were kind of perfectly situated and that our pace of life was going to not really change a whole lot. And then I have to say, like, I've missed the speed of how things were beforehand. You know, I think 2 weeks before things really went bad, I was in northern Italy and kind of traveling around Europe to promote some books. And I realized after the pandemic really went into kind of full swing how much I missed traveling. That it was not something that I ever envisioned for my life, but it's one of the truly like sweet things that I'm really grateful for. And I just miss the freedom of being able to move, you know?
That's interesting. We talked to travel writer Rick Steve a while back, and he talked about he loves to travel. He lives to do it. And he talked about trying to explore his own neighborhood with a traveler's mindset. Have you managed to do that at all? Look at now that you're stuck in your local surroundings, looking at them in a different way?
Yeah, my one thing that was great was that because the stay-at-home measure sort of took place as winter was, you know, fading, my wife and I would get out, and we have about an 8-mile loop that we like to walk south of Eau Claire, south of where we live. And so that was great. I mean, we had more time as a couple to exercise together and talk and kind of decompress. And that I liked very much. And I wish that was something that we continued. We did get to go out to some state parks and, you know, when everyone was just totally stir crazy in the house, and we have two kids. And so that felt good to go up to Copper Falls State Park one day just exploring, you know. I mean, we're so lucky in Wisconsin to have so many great parks, and it felt good to get out and do that.
I was curious to ask you what you've been reading. That's part of what we wanted to invite you to do. Yeah. Check out your pandemic reading list. Anything strike you or new or fun or different?
Oh, Rob, I have to tell you. So one thing that was really sort of fortuitous about the whole thing is that I guess my mom has always kept like a reading journal where she's a voracious reader, reads more than I do, faster than I do. And so she keeps like a journal where she marks down everything she's read and just some brief impressions on what she read. And I started that January 1st, 2020. And
nice.
So it has allowed me to track what I read and remember, because I don't have a great memory. And I mean, first grade book of the year that I read, it's not a new book. It's something I suppose many of your listeners have read, but A Gentleman in Moscow. People had been urging me for years to read this book. And I think because I'm a little bit of a contrarian and also myself an author, I kind of, when too many people tell me a book is amazing, I start to either feel jealous or disbelieving of that. And I mean, I wish A Gentleman in Moscow was 2,000 pages long.
Wow.
Did you read that one?
I have not read that one. And I feel more a sense of a guilt when I hear things that I should have read but haven't, Nick. I mean, because it's a long list.
Yeah.
Like a good one. What's it about?
It's basically about this Russian aristocrat who gets placed under house arrest in a Moscow hotel. And so much time passes over the course of the book that you see him from the, I guess he's in his late 30s, early 40s as this aristocrat who's used to a certain life. And then that falls apart. But you also understand that he's an incredibly intelligent, sensitive man. And you see the ways in which he bonds with other members of the hotel staff. And, you know, I mean, it's such a, I feel like it's been just, you hear people talk about like, oh, I wish this year would be done. I hated this year. This was a great, I've never put a whole lot of stock into that. But I truly feel like 2020 was a miserable year. And it's the kind of book that actually brings you out of that and makes the world look brighter.
Talking to author Nicholas Butler. He lives near Eau Claire. His books include Shotgun Love Songs. Talking about life and reading during the pandemic. Now, Nick, I got to say, this reading journal idea, yeah. I have a thing where I think about having a reading journal for literally for years, and I've never done it. Does it? I don't know. How does that change the way you read, or does it change the way you read? It sounds like a great idea.
I'm sure you read. I'm sure you sort of have to. Read a lot for your work, but you also just enjoy reading flat out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's work reading and then there's Rob reading. That's
for
sure.
I mean, my memory is not good. So I've just found it so handy, like when people are saying to me, well, what have you read recently? And normally I would answer that with like a pregnant pause and really have to scratch my head and think about what I'd read. And now I can kind of look back over the year and survey what I've read and what's really stuck out to me as both good and bad. And because I mostly read in bed before I fall asleep, it's also become sort of this ad hoc dream journal. It's just kind of gotten me back into the, you know, scribbling down a few lines every now and again. So I've you know, when my mom told me that she'd done it, it was like one of those things that your parents do that you they don't necessarily advertise, and you think, well, that's a darn good idea. And so, yeah, I've been it's been fun.
So you're sticking with that?
Well, I hope so. I don't know. We'll see. So far, so good.
Well, we asked our listeners on Facebook to share their reading thoughts. Margaret says she had always been an avid reader, but once we went into lockdown, Margaret says she couldn't focus on a book. Finally, late spring, she eased back in, rereading a couple of old favorites before cracking open and very slowly savoring the final book of Hilary Mantel's Cromwell trilogy, The Mirror and the Light. I read the first one of that. That one, that's one I should pick up. But rereading, I love. I've done a little bit of this myself, Nick. Are you a rereader ever?
Not a whole lot. Part of that is because there's just like a professional responsibility to be reading other people's work, you know, and books that haven't come out yet. So, you know, there are books that I have revisited over my life, and I wish I could go back and read East of Eden, for example, right now. That'd be fun. But it just feels like there's this never-ending supply of advanced reader's copies that I got to plow through. And then I'm happy to plow through, too. So
let's bring out a caller. Bill joins us in Hale's Corners. Bill, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. What a great show. I just turned it on, and really excited to hear the author speaking. And I set myself a goal this year. I hadn't been reading as much as I had wanted to, and back in January, I set a goal of reading 20 books this year. And since the pandemic has hit, I just hit book number 30.
Nice.
So it's been a great reading year. And I just wanted to echo your guest sentiment. Gentleman in Moscow is one of the finest books I've read in many a year. It was just a great read, and I was so sorry that when it was done.
Wow.
And another great book I'd like to recommend, if you haven't talked about it already, is The Dutch House. I believe Patchett, perhaps, is the name of the author, but another one of my favorite books that I've read in the last 7 months.
Awesome. Thanks for those recommendations. We talked to Ann Patchett a few months back, actually. So, Nick, great ideas. Another second on this gentleman from Moscow. All right, guys, I'll check it out. We've only gotten one recommendation from you so far. Nick, hit us with another one.
Yeah. I'm a big baseball fan, and the baseball season didn't start on time. And to me, that's like as important as the birds migrating north or something like that. It's just a change in season. So I was looking for baseball-related books, and I found two great ones. One is called The Cactus League by Emily Niemans, which is a novel sort of told through a collection of short stories, and it's basically about spring training down in Arizona and the different characters that are sort of involved in this fictitious team spring training. And there's a star baseball player, there's groupies, there's coaches that have never quite risen all the way to the top. Really enjoyed that one. I also read a surprising book called The Wax Pack. And I don't know if I'm going to pronounce the author's last name right, but I think it's Brad Balukjian. It's the University of Nebraska Press. And what the guy did is he got a pack of 1985 Topps baseball cards. I also happen to be a kind of closet baseball card collector. And he opened the pack, and then he went and found all 12 of the players in their retirement and just had like a cup of coffee with them and kind of checked in on where their life is now and what they recalled about being professional players. And what came out of that book for me was this notion that, what does success mean? You know, these athletes were at the pinnacle of professional sports, but now 20 years later, what does that mean? Does anyone recognize them anymore? And have their marriages fallen apart because they were on the road all the time as athletes? And I really, really like the book. It started off on kind of I think it's fair to say, like a little bit of a juvenile tone, and you're not sure if you really like the author. And then as the book progresses, you both become more attached to the author and more attached to these mostly forgotten baseball players. Really like that book a lot, too.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Nicholas Butler. His books include Little Faith and Shotgun Love Songs. And we want to hear from you. What have you been reading or putting on your reading list lately? Are you going back to comfortable favorites, or are you digging into new material? What's the best book you've read during the pandemic? Do you feel like you've had more or less time to read? And what about your attention span? Better or worse? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Nicholas Butler, a Wisconsin author based in the Eau Claire area. You might know some of his books like Shotgun Love Songs, The Hearts of Men, or his latest, Little Faith. He writes a column called Sawdust Stories for the Leader Telegram. And we want to hear from you. What's something you've enjoyed reading lately? Are you reading more or less than you might in a normal year? And the big question, have you also read A Gentleman in Moscow, like Nick and so many of our listeners? If you have, what did you think? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We heard from Jocelyn on Facebook. She says she discovered the late great mystery writer Mary Roberts Rinehart, supposedly America's Agatha Christie. Jocelyn says her books are quite the gold mine, but for some reason not widely carried by public libraries. She found some to download for free from the Gutenberg Project. Interesting. That's kind of cool, Nick, when you discover a new author that you love and find out they've written a lot of stuff. Have you ever had that, or have you had that lately?
Yeah, it's, I'm glad you asked, actually. Yeah, there's a mystery writer by the name of Tom Bowman, B-O-U-M-A-N, and I think he's based in New York State, kind of near the Pennsylvania border, and he writes these mystery. I think he's written three mysteries, reoccurring character, and they're set in kind of a Hard Knocks rural area, that part of the country, and they're, I just can't quite put my finger on what it is about his writing, the rhythm of his writing, that just really grabs me. And when I discovered him, I ran through all three of those books, and I wish he had written, I wish he'd write faster, frankly. but I feel the same way about like William Kent Kruger's Cork O'Connor series. And I find that, you know, I think Ann Patchett mentioned this when she was on the show, but when I'm really struggling with my attention span, which can, I think, sort of happen when, you know, the news cycle is so heavy and there's so much at stake and you want to pay attention, but then you sort of get trapped in a negative feedback cycle where you're always looking at your phone. And I find that reading something a little lighter, like a mystery, can help me refocus, not just in my reading habits, but also in my writing habits too. I can just kind of figure out what that speed is or and find that attention span again. So
let's bring on another caller now. Brian is with us in Fort Atkinson. Brian, hi.
Hi. Yeah, this is Brian. I'm a totally blind person. And so, but I've read about 19 books now since the COVID-19 thing started. And
cool.
They're all in Braille.
You do Braille, or I know there's the Bard system of audiobooks, a lot of different ways. What have been some of your favorite reads so far this year, Brian?
So far it's been, I've read a Braille book by Michael Conley. It's his book.
Gotcha. Thanks so much for sharing that, Brian, reading that in Braille. And I'll point out to people, anybody with a visual impairment, the Bard system is an excellent audiobook system. You get a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily commercially available if you have a visual impairment. That reminds me, Nick, of a long time ago, I had a buddy who was blind, and I was kind of his volunteer reader for a while for grad school. And it made me realize some books are really meant to be read out loud. Do you ever get to do that much, like out loud reading, either reading it to someone or someone reading to you?
You know, I've since the pandemic started, I've missed that. You know, when you start off as a writer, you don't necessarily, well, and you know, I'm fortunate too. I mean, I have several books out and traveling to promote those books is sort of part of my job. And I realized that, you know, when everything was normal, I sort of looked at the travel and the time spent in hotels and eating fast food. And it's easy to sort of not see the magic in what you're doing. But then after I couldn't do it, after I looked at my calendar and realized that months and months of events were canceled, and I literally, you know, went to an office supply store and bought 3 bottles of Whiteout and just, you know, tragically canceled all these things I was sort of looking forward to, I realized I love reading out loud. Mm-hmm. And I love trying to find out, like, what I've done right in my own writing and what I've done wrong. And the only way that you can find some of those molecular mistakes is when you're reading out loud. Now that I'm not going anywhere, there's plenty of reading out loud that's happening in the house, but it tends to be a second grader reading me her stories and asking about vocab words. So it's different.
That's fun too.
That is fun. Yeah.
Brian, thanks for calling. We'll go to Polly in Wauwatosa now. Polly, hi.
Yeah, I tried not to call because who likes repetition, but I couldn't keep my fingers off the dial to give another shout out for a gentleman from Moscow. It's probably, I consider
all
it.
All right, people.
A lot of times, like To Kill a Mockingbird, this is the book of our time.
Wow.
Exquisitely written. You wish there were 19 more volumes and you could follow that man into eternity.
Wow. Okay. All right, Nick. I think I'm convinced I got to read this thing, huh?
Yeah. See, these are the kind of endorsements that really bother another writer. Even as much as I like it, it's like, boy, anybody want to call up and say something nice about Shotgun Love Songs or anything now?
Thank you so much for calling in. Yet another recommendation for that. Well, I wanted to ask, Nick, I imagine this has got to be a different world for writers. And I don't know exactly how, and I assume it's different from writer to writer, obviously. How about you?
Well, I think the thing that I think of immediately is that I sincerely feel I feel bad for writers that have books coming out during this. Because a huge component of making sure that your book gets discovered by readers is being out there on the road and going to independent bookstores and making sure the staff connects with you as the writer and is, you know, hand selling your book to readers and going to public libraries. And during this time, you just can't do that. And the news cycle is so topsy turvy as well that, you know, I mean, if you were counting on a 3-minute interview being on public radio on a Saturday and then global politics just changes abruptly, you'll lose that and you lose those readers. So I feel bad for those writers that are trying to promote a book right now. Normally I feel like I'm very disciplined and, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I can publish a book every 2.5 years, but I will tell you honestly that I have not been super productive this calendar year, and it's just been, I think, that kind of simmering uncertainty doesn't help me artistically, you know, and I felt guilty about that for a little while, and now I just feel like, okay, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to operate under these circumstances, and I don't think I have to feel bad about it or anything, but it's just so strange.
Very fair. In our last minute or so, Nick, do you find comfort in reading in this time?
For sure. I mean, I find comfort in beauty. And books have always been one of the aspects of beauty in my life and escapism. And it's a way for me to decompress at the end of the day. And I don't, you know, honestly, it might sound dramatic, but I don't know where I would be in my life without books in the best of times. But I feel so fortunate to live in a house that's full of books that I'll never be able to, you know, have the time to finish all these books. And it's definitely helped me in this time.
Nick, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Nicholas Butler is the author of novels, including his latest, Little Faith. He writes a column for The Leader Telegram called Sawdust Stories. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, read both fun and informative digital articles, and get the latest from the WPR and NPR news departments. Check it out at WPR.org. Coming up next is news from NPR. Then an author makes the case that there's a lot we can learn about creating a thriving middle class by looking to the era after World War II. And he says we need to overcome some basic myths along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.